for, and it's not just smoke and mirrors. These things are based in fact.
Nick, I got to stop you for a second. I just now hit the start broadcast button. I was.
Is that why the thing says not broadcasting?
So Nick, I apologize. We got to kind of take it over from the top.
But you can avoid the embarrassing bit about the dinosaurs now. So yeah, we don't have to tell anybody about that.
This episode of Bourbon Pursuit is made possible through listeners like you, supported through Patreon. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. But as usual, let's go through just a little bit of news and a little bit of thanks. And this is what I want to do first, is I've got to say thanks to JK McKnight, who's been a previous guest on the show, and the entire Forecastle family for hosting me at Forecastle Fest this past weekend in Louisville. I had the opportunity to visit the Bourbon Lodge and see a bunch of awesome bands. But, you know, while at the Bourbon Lodge, they had a whole rarities bar. They had Old Forester Birthday 2002, 2008, a bunch of different ones. But one thing that I got that really kind of stood out was had the opportunity to try the barrel proof expressions that were done specifically for Forecastle, which was Larceny barrel proof. So if you've been paying attention on forums, you might have seen it, but I had the opportunity to try it. So it was a really cool experience. But I just want to say thank you again to JK and Forecastle for allowing me to be able to come. It's always a fun time in Louisville here to be a part of it. You know, speaking of barrels and barrel picks, our next one is done and in the books. Ryan, myself, and three other lucky Patreon supporters went to Barton this past week and picked out a 1792 foolproof barrel. We had five barrels to sample from. They were all from December 2009. And they clocked in somewhere around 126 to 128 proof. So that means we didn't really need to water anything down. And when you were able to narrow it down, we went through a three-way blind and we chose barrel number two at the end of the day. And this is going to be bottled at 125 proof. And we've named it A Case of the Mondays. So if you're a Patreon supporter, you're going to have the opportunity to buy a bottle from this barrel here in the next few weeks. Now, other things we have going on, we also have an Elijah Craig in the works as well. The sign-up sheet is available on Patreon if you want to join us at Heaven Hill in 2 weeks, and we're going to be bringing four Patreon supporters with us. So make sure you go to patreon.com, either if you are already a supporter or want to sign up, make sure you do it quick, because if you're listening to this today, it closes at 6 p.m., and I've got to allow people to give enough time to be able to make travel plans. And, you know, we're really on a roll with these barrel picks, and we're in the works of getting a lot more, too. James E. Pepper Rye, Joseph Magnets, Russell's Reserve, Kentucky Spirit, and more. And this is all made possible by a new connection that we've made with Keg and Bottle out of San Diego. I've been working behind the scenes with Keg and Bottle to actually help give Bourbon Pursuit first crack at every barrel pick that comes to their 10 stores. So if you want your opportunity to help, you know, maybe be a part of these barrel picks or purchase one of these things that we're going to be doing, you have to be able to support us on Patreon, right? It's hopefully one of those great causes that you can get behind. You get access to cool whiskey at the same exact time that that we all get to choose, right? So make sure you go and help support us on Patreon to do that. If you also, you live in a part of the country that doesn't have a great whiskey selection, or maybe just a decent spirits collection, go to Keg and Bottle, KegnBottle.com, and you can shop their huge selection of over 700 plus whiskeys, and it can be delivered right to your door. So make sure you go check out KegnBottle.com. You know, for today's show, I have to admit, when I learned about Nick and the idea of bourbon archaeology, I was a little hesitant. I thought it was just going to be a bunch of dilapidated and run down abandoned buildings, and I really didn't think anybody'd really care about it. But after recording this, having Nick really explain to me the discovery of Bourbon Pompeii at Buffalo Trace, as well as several others, I found a new respect for this. For us bourbon and whiskey geeks, he's uncovering history and roots that had been long forgotten, and he's giving these places a chance to write their story in the history books. So you're going to enjoy this as someone who is looking to unlock more knowledge about the past and just about bourbon in general. And also, if this interests you, if this is something that you want to get behind and do on the weekends, get in touch with Nick, or you can send me an email, kenny@bourbonpursuit.com, and I'll get you connected, and you guys can go and start looking for artifacts on the weekends together. As usual, if you do like the show, make sure you support us on Patreon, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit, where, as I'd mentioned, you get access to barrel picks, coming in, being on barrel picks. You've got bottle totes, t-shirts, koozies, patches, stickers, and more. So make sure you come and look through there. We've got even more news to announce relatively soon as well. So please pay attention for that. If you are wanting to see what we do on the weekends, make sure you follow us on all the social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @BourbonPursuit. And if this is your first time listening, your fifth time, your 10th time, your 100th time, make sure you are subscribing. Go and do it on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. And if you are more of a video person, you're watching this through Facebook or YouTube, go ahead, subscribe or like us on there. We'd very much appreciate it. With that, enjoy this week's episode. Welcome back to the episode of the Bourbon Pursuit Podcast, the official podcast of bourbon. Now doing take two with our guest today. It was a very funny thing that we'd actually been recording for 5 minutes, and I actually forgot to hit the broadcast button. So we missed some good gems, but we're going to try to recreate it. And as people are already saying on here, it happens to the best of us. But today's going to be a pretty interesting episode, and I get to not embarrass myself completely because when we were talking, I was thinking of like, well, let's talk about the history of bourbon, because this is something that everybody loves to talk about. We have an affinity towards this because of old brands, because of old sites, like Old Taylor and all these different places that we get to go to. And I made the remark of like, the only thing I know about history and what we're going to be looking at is basically like the Jurassic Park of bourbon, which is completely wrong because this is not fossil. This is a completely different side of the science here. So I get to save myself the embarrassment of taking away that remark. But with this, it's going to be an interesting episode because we get to look at a lot of the different components that we necessarily didn't understand when it just comes to looking at the history of bourbon in Kentucky and kind of where we got to today. You know, we hear all the time that, you know, at one point there were couple hundred to a thousand distilleries all across Kentucky, you know, big and small. And then at one point in the, you know, the mid 70s and 80s, or should I say probably around the 90s, you know, it got to, you know, like basically like the big five or the big seven, whatever you want to call it. Right. And now we have this other kind of rise of new distilleries coming, but our guest today is going to give us an inside view into what we have going on with the history and the past of all these defunct distilleries that are now buried a several feet underneath dirt. So today we have Nick Laraquente. Nick is a bourbon archaeologist, and I got him through actually looking at the New Orleans Bourbon Festival and trying to figure out, well, what looks unique, what looks like a good topic we can bring. And when I saw Nick's presentation of what he wanted to talk about, I said, we got to get this guy in the show. So Nick, welcome to Bourbon Pursuit.
Hey, I'm glad to be here again.
There we go. Take two. We're going to make this happen this time. So, right. You know, we'll start it from the top once again. And I kind of want to give people an idea was it bourbon that brought you into archaeology, or was it archaeology that brought you into bourbon? How did that really work and started? How did you really get your feet wet with really, brown water in general?
Right. So it was archaeology first through college. It was mostly just a Maker's Mark and Coke. Didn't really think about bourbon that much, maybe a little bit of Wild Turkey here and there, but it was all about archaeology. I studied Spanish presidios, forts on the coast of Georgia and Florida, and looked at hurricanes and how they impacted those people in the 1500s or so, how you could kind of read those stories that had been erased by these storms. And so I came up here to Kentucky. I was going to school at University of Kentucky for a little while before I started working for the state. And I was coming in for a job interview in 2007 or 8. And I was driving by the Old Taylor Distillery, Old Taylor and Old Crow. And it was a super, super foggy day. It looked like a scene out of Silent Hill, probably. And when I saw Old Taylor, it was still abandoned completely. I literally had no idea. I was like, okay, Old Taylor Distillery, who knows what they made there? And it wasn't until later, and I started Googling, realizing that there are really rich stories, not only with that, but with a lot of other distilleries. And I was looking for something for like a research project. I'm from Kentucky. I'm an Army brat. My wife and my mom's family's from here. And I wanted a reason to stay and do archaeology in my backyard. And when I realized there were thousands of distilleries across Kentucky, and archaeologists have looked at a grand total of like four of them, I was like, there's a lot here. There's a lot of stories to be told. And a happy side effect of that is then I got really into bourbon, trying basically everything there is out there and becoming a big fan of the brown water.
Well, that's good. I mean, I think that's it really helps to know what you're researching when you're doing this, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, and it's also, I mean, it's so complex. I mean, the different expressions that you have now, different mash bills, different ways to finish or whatever. But if you look at the basic steps, the fermenting, the distilling, the storage in barrels, a lot of that stays exactly the same from the 1790s up until today. And so by really understanding all the different varieties and the equipment used and all of that, that translates into the materials and the archaeology, the garbage left behind. So pieces of stills or still equipment or whatever. And only by understanding that and the really tough task of doing as much research as possible and drinking as much as possible, you get to learn, you know, the types of things that distillers may have left behind.
We'll get into some of those things that you left behind, because I think it'd be really interesting, because I want to talk about like if bottles are found, which I'm sure more often than not they are. We'll get to that in a minute, but I kind of want to think about what's the driving factor of actually doing archaeology of bourbon sites? Like what is the, I guess, what's the drive, or is there an economic reason of why there is people wanting to dig up these sites and learn more about them?
Yeah. So I guess the basic drive is the stories. I mean, archaeology is all about, oh, and if you guys hear the sound, is there video on this, or is it just
there
sound?
There is. There's a little bit of video. So we get some parrots.
Yeah, you're going to hear these guys. They're starting to talk a little bit. But anyway, so it's all about the stories. Archaeology is very good at filling in the gaps in history, things that have been forgotten either accidentally or on purpose. If somebody's trying to hide things, then they're not writing it down in archives or whatever. So archaeology is a way of slowing down. We look at some of these places that we've maybe known forever. It's been in our backyard, or we go to places like Camp Nelson or whatever. And the sites that have been forgotten that you can only learn through excavating, uncovering those layers of soil and those artifacts, help you piece together a story that may have never been written down at all. It might be remembered by somebody. So one of my good friends, Sam Hawkins, is the grandson of Mel Hawkins, the last master distiller at Canada Dry. So there already I've learned, like, I never thought of Canada Dry, the ginger ale people, as bourbon producers before. But just south of Camp Nelson, on that bridge right when you cross the Kentucky River, their distillery was set up there. And Sam remembers as a little kid, some 50, 60 years ago, he would come down into that valley. The whole valley smells like yeast biscuits, and he thinks he's going to get something to eat. And he says he's disappointed because there's only whiskey to be found, and has some great stories about his grandfather and whatnot. But that's, as far as I know, that's a story that's never been written anywhere. You can hear Sam tell it, but I don't think there's a book that talks about Canada Dry, at least not in that detail. As far as that economic aspect of it, I mean, the distillery really hinges on authenticity, right? It's like, this is the lineage, what you're drinking, whether you can trace it back to Old Taylor or whoever. The fact that this mash bill stayed the same for so many generations, all of that is very valuable in this industry. So the work that I did with Buffalo Trace over the last few years, uncovering the Bourbon Pompeii, we actually were able to figure out how E.H. Taylor was making bourbon at that site. We found his fermenting vat, and they are getting ready to start producing whiskey the way that he was doing in 1882. I don't know what they're going to bottle it as, but it's just fascinating to me that they're actually taking those steps and making this whiskey the way that he was doing it so long ago.
And so I guess when I think about this, you know, when you think about the authenticity of the bourbon and the mash bill and trying to tie all these all together, You know, is it a lot of distilleries that are kind of funding this? Is it the state of Kentucky? Like, where's the money kind of coming from to say, like, Nick, I'm going to put you to work and I want you to go start putting shovels in the ground and digging stuff up and trying to figure out, like, what distillery was here and kind of how to retrace those steps. Where's the funding coming from a lot of this?
I wish there was a more funding for it. At the moment, I've been doing archaeology of distilleries since 2010. And I've gotten paid only for the Buffalo Trace project. And that was because it was tied to that. It's been more of a labor of love. It's a research that I've been doing. And it's funded basically through my volunteer time, a little bit of money coming from the Jack Jewett Historic Site in Woodford County to like buy equipment and stuff like that. And other than that, it's just me and a bunch of volunteers. So what we're doing with the Jack Jewett site is they discovered that Jack Jewett, a Revolutionary War hero that retired in Woodford County, was an early distiller. He built a distillery on Craig's Creek in 1790 or so, and they were interested in trying to find that place. And so through the records, there's a lot of lawsuit documents where he traded his distillery in 1810 for 1,400 gallons of whiskey. And people never paid up, and so they sued each other. And over 10 years, there's landmarks like the distillery is here at this intersection, at this bend in the creek, that kind of stuff. And we're actually able to track down that 1790 distillery. The other fun thing there is that an aspect of the distilling industry you don't hear a whole lot about, except for the new stuff that's coming out with the Uncle Nearest Distillery. Is that Jack Jewett used slaves to do a lot of his distilling for him. So there's stories there that have never really been unpacked before that we can start talking about. We also have things like we can estimate his mash bill, try to approximate what he was making back then, and some things like that. But all of that was basically just a volunteer project with a small historic house site. They were interested in trying to bring tourists in that were interested in bourbon. But because they're owned by the fiscal court, they can't actually have like tastings and stuff like that on their grounds. So it's not like working with a, you know, typical distillery where every presentation, everybody's walking around with a glass and you have a tasting and all of that. It's very much we're talking about the industry without able to enjoy some of the better parts of it, I suppose. But, I mean, if there are any listeners out there that have an idea of how to make this more of a full-time thing, I'd be all ears.
Yes, guess start pushing for those grants, right? I guess that's what you have to do next.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but I am starting to – we're doing a new project with Buffalo Trace this year, working on some buildings that are associated with that OFC distillery. So there's a little bit of funded work coming in.
Well, good. And so I kind of want to talk about the size and kind of what the magnitude of what you have to deal with is, right? Because we've all heard the history that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of micro distilleries all around Kentucky, you know, during, you know, pre-prohibition and stuff like that. So what was the size of that, you know, of how many distilleries that are out there, or how many sites that you know of that you all are actively working on to rediscover or find artifacts from these distilleries as well?
Well, I think if you look at Kentucky histories as a whole, we are definitely talking about thousands of distilleries. I wouldn't call them micro distilleries so much, though. I'm using kind of the framework that Michael Veach and others have laid out in their histories, where you talk about roughly moonshine stills, farm distilleries, and then industrial distilleries. So industrial distilleries are like the Maker's Mark, the Buffalo Trace, the ones we see today, but they would also probably include some of the smaller, the craft distilleries like a Wilderness Trail or Limestone, whatever. Because the main purpose of these places is to make as much whiskey as possible, get it out to market, you age it in the warehouses. If you look back in the 1800s, farm distilleries have a very different purpose. It's not clear that they're always aging their whiskey, if they ever did at all. What they're doing is they're turning corn into whiskey basically to distill money, especially in early Kentucky, because you're bartering or trading gallons of whiskey for things. If it's buying a distillery like with Jack Jewett, or you could be trading, say, 10 gallons for help raising your barn and whatnot. You're not aging the stuff. You're putting in stoneware jugs, because if you put it in a barrel, you lose something like 30% of your volume just instantly. And they didn't really have that kind of luxury at the time. So if you look at a trend, looking like, say, through the 1800s, in 1830s, things become standardized. Kentucky becomes a full cash economy, so you're paying real money for a brand. You expect it to taste the same way every time you crack open a bottle of Old Crow or whatever. So farmers are then standardizing their crops. They're only producing, say, NB yellow corn varieties and giving that all to the distiller in exchange for money rather than distilling on their own property. Over time, as taxes and other things kind of come into place, the farm distilleries just kind of go out of business. They can't afford to be in it anymore, because you either have to ramp up that production, paying all that tax up front, and so only the big boys really get to stay in the industry anymore, or you turn to moonshine. And the moonshine has just got, I'm just really scratching the surface there, because a lot of the times, if you look at moonshine histories, it talks about criminals, extreme violence, the same way maybe you would talk about like meth addicts or something today, right? But if you look at some oral histories, especially around Prohibition, from Nelson County, they talk about these good people that have been dealt unfair hand, overbearing government. They completely understand why they're driven to moonshine, because the entire county's economy is based on this industry that suddenly the government's saying you're not allowed to do anymore. And it's completely unfair. It didn't make sense. So the language with that type of moonshining at that time and that place is very different than what you see in, say, Eastern Kentucky. Sometimes where they're talking about, oh, the moonshiners are also murderers or whatever. So again, very interesting stories to unpack there. And some of Kentucky's identity is really tied to these histories that have been forgotten over time. And it's just, it's too simplistic just to talk about, all right, these guys have been distilling forever. Colonel Taylor, these other big names kind of took over and they made the industry live. I'd rather talk about the Eplers or the Frasers or some of these names that you never hear about and understand maybe why we don't remember about them anymore. Or there's always the chance that we're going to find some innovation, something they did either on purpose or on accident that could create a very tasty variety that would succeed in the market today as well.
Well, kind of talk about that a little bit. One, you know, what's your fascination with these people? Like you said, the Frasers, you know, what was, like, take them as example or anybody else that you could say is a story that they have that has been forgotten in history.
Well, the Epler Distillery is one that's interesting. It's a farm distillery that's in Woodford County, kind of directly west of Versailles as you go out toward Clifton, just north of kind of the Wild Turkey area. And that family, they operated through the Civil War, and they had like a local notoriety almost. If you look at some of the Woodford County histories, the Epler brand of whiskey is known very well. They were two brothers and a sister. They had no kids at all, and all three of them just spent their entire lives distilling. And so I'm still unpacking what their story is, but it's interesting that it's a family business. They succeeded through the Civil War when others closed down because of high taxes or whatnot. Their brand was apparently loved. Some of the smoothest whiskey ever made, according to some newspaper articles. Maybe it was written by like their best friend or something. I'm not sure. And then whenever they all three of them died and pretty close together, the place is just left. And somebody in the 1900s made moonshine there. But as far as I can tell, aside from that moonshiner, the last people that were there were the two brothers and their spinster sister. It's just like they dropped their stuff. And 100 years later, I'm coming and trying to figure out what they were doing. So lots of interesting things there. Haven't quite figured out how that one might tie in with, say, I don't know, a craft distiller that's interested in making these kind of, what would they be, like special edition, like heritage edition, where you have the story attached to whatever their mash bill is. So I don't know. And some of the stuff could taste absolutely horrible by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, totally. I guess that's a good way to kind of put it, because mm-hmm. you know, there's been a lot of people. You can get them at different bars around the country. You know, with the new Kentucky laws, you can go and find some pre-prohibition stuff and try it. You know, I've tried pre-prohibition stuff and it's not that great. And however, you had mentioned that, you know, when you're uncovering these things, you could find something that is a unique way of distillation, or something that is not necessarily, I guess you can say, commonplace in today's distillery yeah. techniques. You know, have you been able to uncover something like that already?
One of the interesting things that I'm seeing is there's a use of gravity in the natural landscape. And I mean, we've replaced that with different types of technology now, but the Epler Distillery is built right on the side of a very steep hill, and they've cut roads into the side of the hill to where they could bring a wagon load of like ground corn up top, dump it in, and then there's water up high on the hill as well that they have kind of dammed up, and they use that kind of natural force of gravity to start the fermenting up top. Then they put it in a still that's a little lower down, so they don't have to, you know, use buckets to bring this stuff up at all. And then as it continues downhill, you can actually see like where their bottling area was, right next to a wagon trail that goes out to the river. So that part of it's interesting, but we've kind of replaced that with different types of technologies, grain elevators or just pipes moving the whiskey from one place to another. So that's not really like needed as much as it was before. But at the same time, is there anything to that process that might have added different flavors or something? I don't know. The only way to tell there would be to actually replicate that process and see.
And so when you're going through and you're looking at a site, I mean, do you have some sort of idea of how big of an operation this was at one point? So when you know, like, are we going to run into a still that is can hold 50 gallons, or is it a still that can hold 5,000 gallons? Like, what's the thought process going in of trying to figure out what am I actually looking for? Because you have to do some sort of research beforehand, right?
Right. And some of it varies, because some of these early sites, like the Epler site, has like a single map and a newspaper article that associated with it. It's how we tracked it down. The Jewett one had a little bit more. So a lot of the learning about the site is in archaeology terms, it's just called phase one excavation. It means you step 27 paces, you dig a hole, 27 paces, dig a hole, and you see what kind of artifacts, what the layers of the soil are. And so, like for the Jewett Distillery, we dug 100-something holes and found artifacts in 76 of them. So one of the things that I've learned, especially with these early sites, that you'll never find really is a still. The stills were extremely valuable. So when you stop distilling, that's one of the first things you sell. The only places you really find the stills on sites is in moonshine sites, whenever people ran afoul of the law and the people come in there with the axes and whatnot. So the things that we do find them is you can find a firebox where the still used to sit. And you mentioned metal detectors, maybe in the first take of this, I don't remember.
Yeah, but, just, I don't know if you're the guy on the beach, right? Like you always, yeah. You always see that old dad on the beach with his metal detector looking for something. Like I didn't know if that was you all in the middle of Kentucky, like trying to find nails or something.
Yeah, so I mean that is one method that we use in professional archaeology. Is there's a metal detector that you can tune to ignore copper and look only. Or ignore iron and look only for copper. And so if you think about a still that's been sitting maybe out in the elements for a while, and there's like little pieces of it rusting off. And so we can actually find in some cases the firebox with an area that's been burned inside, because you got a constant fire going underneath that still. And the idea, even though we haven't found this just yet, is like little flecks of copper that would be around that. So what we found so far is we found areas where the firebox is there, but they've probably built some sort of shelter over top of it. You don't get as much rust, and but yet that copper still is sold away. The things that we also find are like the containers, right? You mentioned something about bottles earlier. We've never found like a full jug of whiskey or anything like that. Most of the time, the stuff is valuable enough that unless you have like somebody with butterfingers on the first day of the the job or whatnot, we found a few broken stoneware jugs from where that person drops it, and maybe they're not allowed to handle the jug anymore or something. I don't know. But the other problem is that since they're work areas, just like with the industrial distilleries, so like Buffalo Trace, they did an excavation there in 2010-ish, where we actually found a reusable trash pit where stuff was coming out of the OFC distillery, put in that trash pit. They clean it out once or twice a week and take it back to the back of the distillery. So you're not leaving garbage like laying around your work area. These early distilleries, the Jewett and the Epler, both, you're not finding a lot in the distilling area because as they have an accident, they drop a jug or whatever, they're picking that stuff up, throwing it in the creek, throwing it somewhere that's not like in that actual work area. So it's actually, I call them ephemeral sites. They are very hard to unpack because there's so few artifacts there. At least most of the time. We got lucky with the Fraser Distillery, which if you've seen the bourbon film, that's the distillery that we're working on in my segment of it. And that one, it qualifies as an industrial distillery. They had a big warehouse and like a railroad running stuff in and out of it. But it burned down right after Prohibition. And for archaeology, that's actually a good thing because that catastrophic event, it kind of packs everything there and they kind of clean off the top and try to rebuild. But as we unpack those layers, you can actually see that burn layer. We found like a piece of carbonized corn in there, and you can see some other elements of the distillery that were just left in place. The Bourbon Pompeii was the same thing. That they had three distilleries there. The first one, Colonel Taylor, ripped down and just kind of left some remnants of it there. The second one burned down in a freak accident where lightning struck and just burnt the whole thing down. And then the third one he built just around there. So we can unpack those catastrophic events and see things where they were left a little bit better than some of these where they're maintained and constantly cleaned. No, I started to ramble there for a minute. Did I answer your question?
It's perfect, man. It's great. I mean, it brought up a lot of other things, you know, too. It was like one thing, what I want to go back to is another thing that you had said about, you know, dig a hole, move 27 paces, dig another hole. Now, how big are these holes? Like, I know you're just not putting a shovel 6 inches in the ground and going, nope, nothing here. Keep moving on, right? Like, like what's that process?
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than a post hole for like a fence post or something like that. It's about the diameter of a round shovel, and you go until you hit either bedrock or there's something called subsoil where you're finding those Jurassic Park fossils and all of that. We're only interested in the human stuff, so we stop where humans no longer impacted the layers. So it looks different depending on where you're digging at. So with Buffalo Trace, they have a lot of flood events, and so the bottom layers where humans no longer were on that area are just kind of clean sand. Well, in Woodford County, there's a lot of clay, and for the Jewett, the Epler, and the Fraser Distillery, the subsoil is all this kind of, there's fossils in it, lots of stone, lots of clay, and those holes that we're digging there are maybe 10 inches deep, maybe.
So you're not really finding anything beyond 10 inches. Is that pretty safe to say then?
It depends on the distillery. Because with, again, Buffalo Trace, we were finding stuff 10 feet, 12 feet deep. But there we were also working with backhoes, and it was inside a building where they had to kind of build up where it slopes down into the river. So there are definitely places in Kentucky. I could think of, there's an excavation that happened in the 90s in Owensboro, where there was stuff deep that they found with the backhoe. But at the same time, I know of archaeologists that have looked for distilleries along Beargrass Creek in Louisville, and they trenched right where the maps show there should be warehouses and whatnot, and there was absolutely nothing. And it could be because the rock and all of that was so valuable that they recycled it, used it in another warehouse or whatever. Mm-hmm. So some of the stuff can be very deep. It just depends on the area of Kentucky you're working in.
Right. And so let's talk about some of those, just the archaeology of these forgotten distilleries. You know, if we, if you look at, by the way, for anybody that's, you know, trying to listen and pay attention, I'm actually looking through his presentation that he gave me from New Orleans Bourbon Festival. And I can see some pictures of, Somebody standing inside, it looks like a concrete vatted tank, basically about up to somebody's neck. There's also a heat map of James E. Pepper that kind of shows what the structure looked like. So kind of talk about what it looks like to start digging in and finding some of these pieces.
Well, I mean, you're basically uncovering a puzzle. You don't know what the whole picture looks like, or if you even have all of the pieces of the puzzle, or how many puzzles you have. Because, like, for example, the Jewett Distillery, when we first went out there, the only thing you can see is two dry-laid stone structures, and it's just like two layers of rock coming up out of the ground. So you can kind of have an idea of like what the width and length of this building was, but you have no idea how tall it was, and you have no idea what the function is. The other thing you can see in that particular distillery is there's this thing, it's a big ditch, it's called a mill race. And so he had a grist mill where he would divert the flow of the creek and make it turn a wheel that would grind his corn for him. And so you could see those three elements. And other than that, it's just like normal woods, very thick woods. So as we start to grade out the site, you dig that first hole and then you walk the 27 paces or whatever. And it's almost like playing Battleship, because you're doing presence absence, right? So you're trying to see, all right, there's nothing around these distillery, the actual foundation walls. Why is that? And could be because of the cleaning. As we move north a little bit, though, what we found was a break room of sorts. So we found a lot of cooked bone, some knives and other utensils, and you could actually see in the bone these saw marks from where somebody had like basically made beans with a ham bone in it, and they dumped it there whenever they were done, and they burnt other kinds of garbage and whatnot there as well. So we were joking that that's maybe the break room, because the date of the artifacts, like the way the fork looked, it is a early 1800s fork. So, and that was the time the distillery was working. But I mentioned that thing about the other types of puzzles. 50 to 100 years after that place operated as a distillery, it became a place that was kind of, there was a house nearby and somebody's burning like their garbage out there in that area. So we found hundreds of buttons to close where somebody's probably like dumped off clothes. They rotted over time, more garbage burnt on top of it. And then in the top of all of these layers, as we're unpacking this, is there's these big ruts, because the roads that they cut into the hill, again, for that historic use for the moving the bourbon down to the river or to put stuff in the top of the grinder or whatever, they're very good for four-wheeling. So there are all these ruts where people would four-wheel and get air on these terraces on the hill, and they would run up the site, too, as a result. So, lots of different stories there, not all of it related to the distillery, but if you approach it kind of surgically and take these pieces apart, you can say, all right, in this area, 2 feet down or whatever, this is where we have the distillery stuff, and we approach this a little bit more carefully. So I think if you look in the presentation, and maybe you could stick a picture of this on your site or whatnot, there's a larger unit where you can actually see me. Well, maybe it's not in this one. I'll send you a picture of it. We open up these things that are sometimes they're like telephone booth sized holes. So they're like 1 by 1 meter or 1 by 2 meter. So when you use that shovel testing to find an area that's interesting, you can open it up to look at those layers a little bit better. And I'll send you some pictures of what that looks like.
And so what's the, I guess when you find something, like what's your eureka moment, right? I guess you could say, when you found something, or is you, cause you had mentioned that there was somebody that went through all the banks of a creek where there should have been a distillery, yet there was just no sign of anything that was ever there. So what's that sort of eureka moment like for you?
Well, I mean, there's a few eureka moments. So the first one with the Jewett Distillery, we spent months looking for this thing. Like there was all these documents. We had all the landmarks. I actually walked 3 miles down the creek looking for spots that it could be. And then when we found the spot that it was most likely to be, we have a bunch of people out there and we're digging a whole bunch of empty holes. I think like the first day, I don't think we found anything at all. So I'm sitting at home sweating that night being like, I hope there's something there or else I'm wasting everybody's time. So that first eureka moment is when we find the first artifact and we know there's a site there. So I don't even care what the artifact is. I think for the Jewett site, the first artifact we found was like a button that popped off of somebody's pants as they were like sliding down the hill. And that was good enough. It had nothing to do with the distillery itself ultimately, but you know, there's something. So then the second eureka moment is whenever like we're looking for this thing, it's like, all right, the distillery's here. We know these artifacts are associated with the distillery. And it's not until we find like a piece of a stoneware jug or a piece of copper, something like that. So at the Jewett Distillery, it was a fragment of the stoneware jug, which you can put lots of different things in stoneware jugs. But that was one of the indicators of whiskey at that time, because they're putting it right in those jugs. And we had this account of this guy that would hitch rides in a wagon down to the river in a wagon's full of these jugs. But I got a chance once in, maybe it was 2009, maybe 10, I don't quite remember, but I got to work at the original still site of Woodford Reserve. So they got a big sign up, it's on the other side of the lagoon from where the still is now. And we were not finding anything there. It was like a few nails, a few like really early bricks, and not finding anything.
And was this the Pepper Distillery?
No, this was, I don't have anything about this in the presentation, but, the Pepper House was there up the hill, and University of Kentucky was working on the Pepper House, but, they let me go and look at the still. And, there we actually found a copper hydrometer. It was all bent up. Obviously you couldn't use it anymore, but it doesn't get any more, it doesn't get any more distillery than that. I mean, there's really only one purpose for copper hydrometers. So that was a big eureka moment for me.
But yeah, I was about to say, it sounds almost a little more exciting than finding a button or a nail or something like that, right? Because a button or a nail could be to anything. But you know, there's only one reason why you'd have a hydrometer sitting around.
Yeah, exactly. It was similar to like at Buffalo Trace. I mean, the OFC distillery excavation was like a once in a lifetime thing, because there you have the actual fermenting vats that Taylor made that were just buried and forgotten by a concrete floor. And I mean, after exposing those things, like, because they're just sitting there, and we use these concrete saws to cut open the floor, and there's a void where everything that filled that fermenting vat settled over time. So we cut a big square out, and the concrete just falls into darkness. And the construction workers are like, do you want to go down there? I was like, not so much. So we ended up exposing the rest. So
isn't this how like Ghostbusters 2 started, with like the slime going underneath the city or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly like that. Yeah. So yeah, so there's definitely a few moments, but a lot of it also comes whenever you like you step back, you're looking at the hundreds of artifacts. Like for the Jewett Distillery, you found 1,176 artifacts. And when you start to look at like, all right, the groups of these things, and you got the kitchen stuff all focused in this area, or the stuff that might be distillery, focused in this area. Seeing that big picture and that puzzle you've been working to recreate over the last year or so, that's a huge rewarding moment there.
Yeah. I was about to say, I was like, I want to talk about the OFC stuff here in a second, but like with the Jewett Distillery, what kind of, you know, you said this is all pieces of a puzzle. So at this point, what is that story starting to come together? Like what can you gather from it, from either a family history perspective, the history of the distillery, like anything else that is sort of coming together from it?
Yeah, I'm in the stage right now where we're writing the report. It's like, this is what all this stuff means and what the next steps would be. So just like making good bourbon, this takes time. It would go a little faster if it was actually funded, but you know, whatever. So
we'll get there. Yeah,
we'll get there eventually. It'll work itself out. So the stories that we're uncovering, we get people involved. Let me back up a little bit. So the way that we went about this, where we opened it up to where anybody that was interested in whiskey history or being outside could participate, that in itself was interesting because we learned about other distilleries, but we also had people that were descendants of Jewett. So his great-great-great-granddaughter actually came and worked with us and had some documents from their family archives or whatever. And it's interesting having artifacts that he had maybe worn. We had this button, a big copper button with 13 stars on it. And people were like, well, maybe that came off of his Revolutionary War uniform. We don't know. But just that idea with her like holding it and like processing it in the lab was very cool. But as far as the actual stories coming out of it too, when you start to talk about, this is what Jewett was doing, one more aspect of his life. He was using slaves to distill. We don't know their names, but just the fact they're here, we can talk about that contribution to the industry and maybe how that influenced some other things perhaps. But we've also discovered his mash bill. So in that series of litigation papers, they actually have a proportion of the reason that we're not paying Jack his 1,400 gallons is he promised to give us the grain, and we want the grain in these proportions, and they list them out. So we have, this is where the water source is, because the spring's there on the site. We have the proportions of grain, and they're using wild yeast from that valley to just get everything going. And we could theoretically recreate Jewett's bourbon, his whiskey, and put it in a stoneware jug, and that could be interesting in itself. But I think the other payoff of all of this too is just a lot of people are starting to see, like, this is how you go about doing archaeology. This is the history that's like buried like right in underneath our feet most of the time. And since the industry intersects so many different things, like you can talk about evolution of technology and tracking how stills progress over time or whatever. You can also talk about Kentucky's integration into global markets with early whiskeys. Even Jack's whiskey was shipped down to Louisville, packaged by rectifiers, sent off to New Orleans or whatever. And then you also see where they're participating in the global market, where you have some Chinese porcelain that's there on the site in the middle of nowhere, Woodford County, from 1790s or so. You can also talk about intersections of like religion, the influence of the temperance movement, things like that. So we are making a story, but I think the more important thing to me is we're making a platform that we can use to jump off and talk about archaeology of all of these other things in Kentucky, which ties in a lot with what professional archaeologists are already doing. Like we found, archaeologists in general have found 35,000 archaeological sites around the state, everything from 13,000 years ago to 50 years ago. And this is a good way to provide like an introduction to people that have maybe never heard about that. You fall in love with bourbon, you get involved with bourbon archaeology, and the next thing you know, you're learning about the beginnings of agriculture in Red River Gorge. So there's a lot of different things going on.
So with that, we'll kind of shift in the last phase of this, and that's kind of looking at the poster child of bourbon archaeology right now, which is Bourbon Pompeii at Buffalo Trace. You know, you had kind of mentioned of you know, opening, you know, taking a concrete saw and creating the openings, but kind of give an idea of what was the process of uncovering that a little bit more in depth in really. Because today you can go there and you can see, you can walk around, you can, you know, some of it's sort of gated off. You can kind of look around. But what was the process of uncovering that? And what did you all really find when you were doing it too?
Yeah. So the way the project started was they decided that they wanted to put that building to use for like wedding reception space, that kind of thing. Something that they could rent out and get some income from. And the building itself, the wall that faces the river was starting to slump into the river because of different moisture issues and whatnot. So what they were going to do was they were going to repoint that whole wall, like take all the mortar that's crumbling and get good mortar in between the stones and the brick. And that was going to help stabilize it. In order to do that, you rip up that floor and you would dig down the foundations and get all the stuff that was kind of 10 feet underneath. When they ripped up that floor, they started running into old foundations that had been basically buried in concrete by Shinley distillers in 1952 or 53 and forgotten over the last 70-ish years. So they called me at that point because I had done some work for them in 2010 looking at what they call the old Taylor House now. And they're like, we found something old on the distillery. And I ignored the call at first because, I mean, they're always finding something old.
It's old news at this point, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, they probably found a bottle or something like that, right? So, but then they called back, and Dennis and Meredith were both like, no, you seriously need to get over here and look at this. And so when I went, if you've ever been to Bourbon Pompeii, the whole area where the catwalks is, that area had been pulled up. You could see kind of the tops of all the different foundations that are still there now. And when I was went in there and looked, it's like, all right, these things have we call them stratified deposits in archaeology jargon. Basically, it looks like a nice, neat layer cake. So if you were to go from the surface going deeper, each layer goes a little bit further back into the past. And since it's not all mashed up, like something has been subjected to a kid's birthday party or whatever, you can actually start to unpack those layers and say, all right, this layer 4 feet down is 1882 to 1885, and we know that because of this and this. So that stuff is like is super sexy when you're looking at it as an archaeologist. So they gave me a weekend. They're like, we need to stay on a project. We need to you can take a weekend, document whatever this is, and then we need to keep moving with it. And so at the end of the weekend, I was talking about the dirt layers to them, and I was all excited, and I happened to mention, like, the brick wall that you see here in the picture is where the fermenting vats are, and one of them is, like, the kind of record scratch, right? And they're just like, wait a minute, what? You mean fermenting vats? Like, those things are still there underneath the floor? And that's when the project changed. It was no longer really wedding reception. It was more like Mark Brown told us to keep digging until we got to China. We had to find basically everything that was there. So we exposed all of those fermenting vats. And that's when Carolyn Brooks, their historian, she actually found the lithographs. It was in a book that's been around for a little while, right? But when we're looking at it again and we see those images that actually have the fermenting vats going down that room, we're like, this is extremely accurate. This is like somebody was just sitting here watching this stuff happening. It's even got like architectural details, right? So over the next year or so, since I have a full-time job with the state, I popped out during my lunch breaks and on weekends and spent about a year working on unpacking what the stuff is and documenting the artifacts and whatnot, and then helping put that exhibit together to tell the story of how Colonel Taylor influenced those distilleries and what's still standing there today. And then the bonus of it is we actually have enough to start recreating that whiskey. So it's a lot of fun. If you go there now on a tour, they're actually starting to reactivate one of those vats. And I'm pretty sure the idea is that it's going to be relined in copper and actually be bubbling away, fermenting while tourists are coming through and you can look down on it from the catwalk. I don't know what they're going to call it. So hopefully we'll be able to get some of it. I don't know. We'll see.
They owe you. Market Brown at least says you have a bottle, right?
So. Yeah, exactly. At least give me it. Let me put my finger down the vat and taste that at least.
So. Well, that's cool, man. I mean, that's super exciting because it's something that, you know, for the most part, I mean, if you look at just the way that modern, I guess you can say building and every construction. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, like tear it down, start building new, right? And, you know, keep pouring the foundation, keep going on top. We hardly ever start thinking of digging, right? And I think it was really cool that they had this idea to allow you to start going in there and start uncovering a lot of those things. Other than the vats, like, was there anything cool that you also uncovered during this process?
Well, we actually found pieces of that copper sheeting inside the vats. So what I'm thinking is Schindley Distillers, whenever they decommissioned the building, they recycled all of that because it's, what, 8 fermenting vats that were lined. They're 14,000 gallons a piece. That's a lot of copper sheeting that you can use for something else. So you can actually see axe marks in some of this, in some of the copper sheeting where they're trying to take it all out to recycle it. So we found a lot of that. And then we also found a few pieces of their copper spigots that were used in some of the plumbing around. So it was interesting because, I mean, really, you could put the number of artifacts that we found on the table there in front of you. It was maybe 100 or so. And I think the reason for that is, as an industrial site, again, you have that problem keeping everything clean. And so we're not finding a lot of junk in there. Lots of soil, lots of stone, a few bricks, but not a lot of really unique things aside from that copper and the copper spigot. But those things by themselves was enough to tell like a tremendous story, which is interesting.
I guess the last question I'll ask is, how do you reverse engineer a mash bill sometimes, right? Because it says that a lot of times you're able to figure out like what was that grain bill that they were using. You know, you had mentioned one time of kind of like looking at a newspaper article and kind of, I guess you'd say reverse engineering that. But is that typically the way it's done, or is there a scientific way of, you know, scraping the inside of a pipe and finding the yeast strain, or like, I don't know what that really looks like.
Well, I think part of the problem is going to be that there's so many different, what do you call them? I guess species of yeast that if you do a culture, you're going to come up with who knows what. It could be the stuff that was actually in that particular still, or it could be something that's just wild and got in there and contaminated it. Yeah, so there is that problem with the yeast. But as far as the mash bill itself, most of the time it's going to be through documents, because you can get the proportions then. If I was to find, say, just a piece of a still that had residue from the last run in it, that stuff, you could say, all right, there's barley in this, there's rye in this, there's corn in this. You might be able to talk about the variety of corn, but you're not going to be able to talk about the proportion of those grains to each other, which is the critical part for the mash bill, right? So you might be able to find something like an unusual species of corn that was used before that's not anymore, but that proportion is really something that we need the archival documents for. So you can get it through lawsuit stuff like we did with Jewett, or you can get it through, say, industrial censuses, like, or when somebody dies and they do like an estate inventory, and it's like, all right, you have, I don't know, this many bushels of rye, this many bushels of corn. You can get close to approximating things that way.
Interesting. Oh, cool. Well, I think, that's all the questions I have. I mean, it was really interesting because, you know, it was a take that we've never done on this show before of looking at another angle of history with bourbon. And I think it was really cool and definitely appreciate you coming on the show. I want you to give our listeners, you know, access, or tell them what your Twitter handle is or anything like that, of where they can find you publicly and they can follow you, and maybe how they can help, you know, give some funding to help these projects go along too.
Yeah, definitely. So my Twitter is at archaeologist, and I'm on Instagram at Bourbon Archaeology. And if you Google the Jack Jewett Archaeology Project, you get all the contact info for that volunteer-run project that I mentioned earlier. And the Woodford County Heritage Commission, the people that kind of oversee that, they would always be happy to take donations to help that thing run, like help us do exhibits or pay for volunteers' meals and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, just give me any time through social media or whatever, and we can definitely chat. Or once we start up again this year, anybody that's interested in hiking outside or bourbon or archaeology in general is more than welcome to join the Jack Jewett Archaeology Program and actually get their hands dirty doing some of this stuff.
And he'll let you use the metal detector.
Yeah.
Well, good deal, Nick. I want to say thanks again for coming on. Make sure you follow Nick on Instagram and Twitter. Make sure you follow us as well on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Bourbon Pursuit. If you like what you hear, make sure you support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/Bourbon Pursuit. We've got a lot of cool things such as patches, stickers, koozies, bottle totes, and more, monthly giveaways, access to barrel picks, and stuff like that. So go there. You can help donate, help support the show, but get a lot of cool stuff in return. If you want every new show beamed to your inbox, go to bourbonpursuit.com, scroll down, you'll find a little email button. Go ahead, register, and every new episode will be beamed straight to your inbox. If you have any other show suggestions, fan mail, hate mail, whatever it is, send us at theduo, theduo, at bourbonpursuit.com. Nick, thanks again for joining, and it was really a pleasure to definitely get to see this different angle of bourbon. And
awesome.
We'll, yeah, and we will see everybody next week.